The Dr. Taz Show.
The podcast. Dr. Taz.
Your good health journey starts now. Here's Dr. Taz.
Welcome back to the show. Joining us today is Dr. Jay Lombard. Dr. Lombard is a neurologist with additional training in psychiatry. He received his medical degree from Nova University and his postdoctoral medical training at the Long Island Jewish Medical Center. He served as chief resident of neurology at Westchester Square Medical Center, Brain Behavior Center in Rockland County, New York, and then at Bronx Lebanon Hospital. He is currently in charge of the Brain Performance Program at Lifespan Medicine. Welcome, Dr. Lombard.
Thank you very much for having me.
We are so pleased to have you on the show, and this is an area that I am just absolutely fascinated by, and I'm really looking forward to having a discussion with you so you can shed some light on that. I've always maintained that the brain, like many other parts of the body, is plastic, is changeable, and it seems like you've spent a lot of time studying the brain and how our thoughts impact the brain. Talk to us a little bit about your work and kind of what led you down this road.
Well, first of all, I'm glad that you mentioned that, because I think there is a very strong notion in the community that brain injury and the people with various damage to the brain, whether it's post-stroke or post-concussive syndrome, that these are irreversible and intractable problems. And in fact, most of the conventional experience that people have with serious head injury, this is indeed the fact. Unfortunately, I think there's a delay in the translational neuroscience, meaning that we do know that the brain has tremendous neuroplasticity, but you have to know exactly what you're doing to help promote neuroplasticity.
And for our listeners out there who may not 100% understand, you and I can talk about neuroplasticity and understand real quickly. How would you describe that concept? What would you explain that very simply as?
Very, very simple. It's the ability for the brain to regenerate. So we classically were taught that brain injuries were irreversible, and we now know that while the injury itself may be irreversible, the brain has the ability to create new synapses and new wiring in the brain to actually compensate and to recover from various types of brain injuries.
And I think that is the miracle, honestly. It's the miracle of how the human body works. It's the miracle of science. It's the miracle of our spirit, and we'll get there in just a second as well. But it's a message I keep trying to stress to my patients, as I'm sure you do yours, that you can change your brain, that there are ways to rewire, reconnect areas that may have been lost or damaged. What are some of the key things that you advise someone to do when they may have had a brain injury or they may have had a trauma? What seems to work the best in terms of recovering, rebuilding those synapses? What have you found to be the most effective?
That is a fantastic question. Thank you for asking it. So I think that the first most important aspect of healing from any disorder, let alone a brain disorder, is to have hope. I think that many of the people that we encounter on a daily basis feel hopeless, and they feel that these problems are irreversible. And that is, I think, the first thing that we must overcome is our own skepticism and doubt about the reversibility of these types of injuries. So I think that the first step here is really existential, if you will, meaning that people feel they have a purpose to recover and that the injury itself may lead to a greater understanding about their own lives.
Wow, I love that. So have hope, and may lead you somewhere that you don't expect. So that's your first one. What else would you recommend?
Well, I think, you know, that quite frankly, that's sort of the key. I would say that from a practical viewpoint, the way to understand this is as follows: that think about a traffic accident, and you know, there's a huge blockage on, you know, I-95, major traffic jam, but you are so familiar with the neighborhoods that you're able to form an alternative route to get to your destination. This is true with how the brain regenerates itself. When there are tracks that are damaged, whether from a stroke or from a head injury, the brain will find alternative routes to get to their destination. And that type of concept is being used clinically for this field of neuroregenesis or neuroplasticity, meaning that by exposing and training the brain to experience different types of experiences that it previously had not experienced. There's a learning that takes place both behaviorally but also neurochemically that changes the shape of the brain and helps promote recovery.
And are you seeing this on an image? Are you seeing it in the under the microscope? Are you seeing it in blood work? Where do we, you know, it's one thing for a lot of us to sit back and be like, okay, let's have hope, let's have positive thinking. But wow, it's so powerful and so different to say, look, you need to do this because this is what we see. This is the evidence of what we see. So, you know, where are you seeing this when it comes to the research?
Yeah, so I think that's a great question. So, you know, clinically is clinical, right? And I always tell my own patients or clients that, you know, the harshest critic of a treatment is the response that you see. You know, recovery is very much experiential for people who are going through recovery for brain injuries. But in terms of the basic science research, the answer is all of the above. We can see, you know, in animal models, how the brain can regenerate through a variety of different types of behavioral techniques. Obviously, they can study, you know, the brain tissue in a direct manner, where we can't do that in humans for obvious reasons. But as far as other, you know, biomarkers, if you will, or modalities that can demonstrate, you know, the possibility of brain regeneration, that data is actually available for people to review for themselves. And I would say it's really a two-sided coin. And what I mean by that is that we know a lot about how negative emotionality affects the biology of the brain. And we also know, to a certain extent, how positive emotionality, positive spiritual states, positive affirmation of life and relationships affects the brain in positive ways. But mostly we think of this more in a diseased way. That is, you know, what is negativity do to the brain? But the flip side of that is, you know, what is the alternative? Can we overcome those problems?
I find that absolutely fascinating. And so, again, focusing on hope, focusing on positive thought, you know, it's not as easily said, you know, especially for people that have been through trauma or have been through stressful life events. You know, are there tools or techniques that you tell a patient to go ahead and start right away? Like something, you know, it's one thing to leave somebody with, okay, let's be hopeful, let's be positive. But if you had to recommend one thing to your patients or to me, you know, and I could tell you a million different stories about just even within our own family, how the trauma we've been through, how each of us as children have turned out differently because of the tools and techniques we've each used to change our brain. Like, what would you, from your perspective, where you're sitting, what would you tell our listeners? What are the one or two things that they could do?
Well, the first and foremost thing is not to blame the victim. I think that people with head injuries who have a very difficult time recovering, because these are very substantial and much more difficult than healing from other parts of the body. These patients need the full support of their families to understand that many times brain injuries have primarily psychological manifestations like depression and anxiety. Mm-hmm. People say, "Oh, just, you know, what's wrong with you? How come you haven't gotten better? I mean, your head injury occurred a year ago, for God's sakes." And people just don't understand the severity and the magnitude of those injuries. One of the benefits of actually having newer types of brain imaging beyond just a conventional MRI scan is to demonstrate for both the patient and also for their loved ones that there are structural bases for their psychiatric symptoms. And that's a very important aha when you could actually show a patient, you know, specific biomarkers. You know, my research is in all biomarkers in the brain, so not only imaging but also genetics. But we can use a lot of different tools to really help us understand the biochemistry of brain injury, and once we understand that, we're able to put the pieces back together in specific ways. And those specific ways are anything from pharmacological to nutraceutical to really just very simple diet and lifestyle changes that seem very obvious, but they're really not so obvious because they're specifically designed for that particular patient in mind.
And and all of that does, again, to your point, it has to be individualized, it has to be customized, because it's not a one-size-fits-all, correct, when it comes to treating these patients?
It is never a one-size-fits-all. And that's my biggest frustration with just evidence-based medicine, is that, you know,
it's
really moving us towards this one-size-fits-all model when it's just the exact opposite of that. It's not a one. It's called the N-of-1 approach.
I know. You know, it's so funny that we're having this talk today. My husband was showing me last night, you know, he was showing me something on social media. You may have seen it, where Thomas Edison essentially brought a note home to his mom, and his mom looked at him and said, okay, well, this note says you're so smart and you're such a genius that the school no longer wants you. And fast forward about however many years, his mother dies and he was going through her stuff. And essentially he found that note. And what the note said was, your son is mentally retarded. He's deficient. The school does not have the support services that he needs. So please keep him at home. So it's amazing, again, the power of thought and what it does to the brain and what we can and cannot believe. You know, you have a book coming out, I think, right around the corner, June 13th, right? Called The Mind of God. I am absolutely fascinated by this. I would love to learn more about what this particular book is about, because essentially what you have found is that there is scientific evidence, maybe there is something within our brain itself that sort of defends the presence of a higher power. God, I'll let you take it from there.
Well, first of all, that's a great segue. The anecdote that you just talked about, you know, about how our thoughts affect our biology. You know, thoughts are not physical, right? They're totally non-quantifiable. So really, if we want to understand, you know, the concept of God, we have to give up the idea that we can quantify it as a concept at all. The only way we can think about God is by thinking through our thoughts, and our thoughts in many ways can help us either manifest God in our lives or deny the existence of God. We have a choice to do that. We create sort of our relationship with God by our awareness of each other being you know, components of the universe and the oneness of God. And when we recognize that, God shows up in our lives in very, very unusual and surprising ways. But it's difficult to, you know, for everybody to keep that consciousness in mind, because we always think about ourselves and what we need and, you know, our physical issues and everything else. But it's kind of letting go of that and saying, okay, you know, there is a great unknown. And anybody who thinks that they have this universe figured out is full of crap, because the universe is so far complex beyond any scientist's imagination that most quantum physicists just say, oh, it's the only reason why this is so confusing is that there are multiple universes and this is just one of many. Basically, it's like saying, well, we just don't know. We've reached the limits of our understanding about the creation of the universe. And I don't think that while we've reached, you know, our understanding about the mechanics of the universe, we will never understand, you know, sort of the absolute mind of God that created us and is not only created us, but is constantly creating the universe every second of our existence.
I find that so interesting, because, you know, many of us are raised in different religions with the idea of this paternalistic God or a friendly God, right? And sort of, I remember being a little girl and imagining God in the clouds as a person. And I remembered like shaping him, like one cloud was his head and then the middle was his body. And that was God. So it was this person or this thing. And, you know, some religions have a damning God, so to speak, which there's punishment and retribution and all this other stuff. And it's responsible for a lot of the violence in the world that we see today.
Yeah.
You know, again, going back to my husband, he'll talk about how, to a certain extent, you know, the religions of the world have created violence because they isolate us, they segregate us, they section us off. So when you're thinking about God, and then we're thinking about it more as energy or something that is very hard for us to understand, how does that connect back to what you've studied about the brain? And what does the brain tell us, you know, and trying to understand everything that's happening in the brain with just thought and with trauma and emotions and things like that? What does the brain tell us about the existence of God and what we can do, you know, moving forward in our lives to enhance that, or what we do that sort of takes that away?
What a beautiful question and a wonderful segue. You know, the irony about the word religion or the way that religion shows up in our lives is that the Latin roots of the word religion means to bind together. if you think about the unfortunate fact that religion really separates us as opposed to binding us, is really counterintuitive to the purpose of religion, you know, which is, again, to bind us. And to answer your question about the biology of the brain and its relationship to faith, that's what exactly what the book is about. And, you know, we really approach the universe through two brains, not one brain. We have a left hemisphere, which is our rational brain, but more importantly is really it asks itself what the world can do for it. So our left brain is all about, you know, sort of utility. Okay, what's Dr. Taz, what's she going to do for my book, you know?
Right. Right. A left
brain question. But the right hemisphere of the brain is all about relationship, and we know that for any type of relationship to have a very non-quantifiable but deeply enriching relationship, it's really a right hemispheric function of our brains. And that also is the regions that are most specialized to receive this concept of God. And the concept of God, you know, really, I'm contradicting myself by saying that there is no concept of God, but the only concept that we have closest to it is not cognitive at all. It's completely intuitive, it's spiritual, it's heartfelt, and therefore, you know, language does not really appropriately suit our connection to it. So if people, you know, learn to get more into their right hemisphere of their brains, and I certainly don't have any, you know, magic tricks on how to do that. I mean, it's, you know, this is a learning process for everybody, you know, in the world. But the more that we actually focus on our relationships and heartfelt relationships, the more right brain we're activating. And the process of activating our right brain, we make ourselves more receptive to sort of the universal message of God's love.
Wow, that is powerful, powerful words. The mind of God, it also answers 7 questions about spirituality in general and how the brain was designed for faith. And the time we have remaining, I don't want to give it all away, but maybe touch on a few of those questions about spirituality, some of what you're addressing within the book, to give my listeners a sense of what you're diving into in this book, which sounds amazing, and I can't wait to get my hands on it.
Well, the book is really about asking the question. You know, there are no easy answers to any of these questions, right? So the book is really about each person taking their own individual journey to explore the questions in their own lives. Like, for instance, you know, does life have purpose? Well, by definition, life is purpose. I mean, you can't have life without purpose. I mean, you know, any biologist will tell you that biology is essentially purposefulness. It's all about order and coordination and homeostasis and balance. And without those kinds of, you know, push and pull, you can't have life. So life and order are really very much synonymous. So when people ask, well, life has no purpose, they're really missing the picture here, because their life, of course, has purpose. It was, you know, for them to be
why
born.
Why does somebody miss it? Like, how does somebody... You know, I have my own theories, and I see it sometimes in the exam room, but why does somebody get so off course? Why do you think somebody out there is feeling like they've lost purpose or have no purpose?
That's a very easy question to answer, and it really has to do with trauma, right? So when we experience trauma, and we've all experienced trauma, I mean, no one is immune to trauma, but that's when we get off course. We say to ourselves, if life truly had purpose, this wouldn't have happened to us. When in fact, in retrospect, when we look at our life stories, we realize that those traumas were really turning points in our lives in ways that changed us fundamentally, but we don't see it when we're going through it. So it's kind of sad, but who has not concluded that life is purposeless? I mean, I think everybody, if they're honest with themselves, has asked that question, you know, at least 100,000 times. I'm envious of anybody who never asked that question. You know, I know what my purpose is, and this is what it is. But perhaps those people should also question, you know, their own assumptions about their purpose. maybe you know, the people who are asking are really more honest than the ones who already figured it out. But you know, so purpose is embedded in our brains. Our brains essentially create their own homeostasis by finding purpose. You know, whatever that purpose actually is, the brain's job is to actually, you know, to execute that purpose, right? So the brain runs on purpose is essentially the message of the book, and once you realize that the brain is functioning with purpose and on purpose, the question for me is why, right? Why do we have brains at all? You know, I mean, it's not that great a thing to have. I mean, they're very vulnerable. They get broken by a lot of different types of things, emotional and physical. And the manifestations of broken brains, like you mentioned earlier, can be very, very consequential to our society. You know, where you have people that blow themselves up thinking that this is, you know, something that's spiritual, right. Is, you know, essentially a very, very broken brain. And, you know, we need to understand how those brains have gotten broken and how to help fix them. Because we're not going to be able to, you know, essentially secure our future as humanity without understanding our brains better, both in terms of what makes them well, but also what makes them sick. And, you know, again, it's two sides of the same coin. You know, brains that are sick are brains that believe that life has no purpose or has a single purpose, which is violence or aggression. Both of those extremes are really bad places to be.
Well, I have chills right now, and I cannot wait to read this book, because that brings us right back to the idea of trauma. It brings us back to where we started, that to lose purpose, essentially, for my listeners, I hope you caught that our biology is to have purpose. And when we do lose purpose, it's usually because we've experienced trauma of some kind. And we're seeing that reverberate around the world today, where we have broken brains, essentially, wreaking havoc in different areas of the universe. So, you know, yep. For us collectively, hopefully we can heal and bring everybody back together, which is what religion is supposed to do. Hopefully there is hope, and I think it's all of our collective responsibilities to continue to reemphasize the message of hope from wherever we are to everyone, so that maybe we can send some healing energy to these very, very broken people. Dr. Jay, tell us a little bit about where we can get your book. Where should we find you? And this is a topic that I love and I'm incredibly passionate about. In fact, I'll probably talk to you later about a different project I'm working on when it comes to the female brain. But I want all my listeners to read this book. I feel that we have a responsibility to understand how our thoughts and our energies transmit across the universe and how they affect everybody, and maybe to expand and stretch our definition of God. So how can they find this book before I keep talking forever?
Well, first of all, I love the female brain. So any advice, I can't say I'm an expert on it, but I'd be glad to hear sort of the conversation at least, because it's a beautiful brain, the female brain. I'm a strong believer that if we had more female leaders in the world, we would have much more peace in the world than we have right now.
Yes,
but that's a whole other conversation. But
we'll bring you back for that one. How's that?
So where's the book? So the book's going to be, you know, at the usual places, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, your local bookstore, hopefully. You know, wherever you could find a book, there it'll be there, because, you know, Random House is very excited about the book. It's gotten really, I mean, I'm so grateful. It's gotten tremendous reviews from people like Deepak Chopra and Rudy Tanzi and Dr. Lloyd Federer, and some really, you know, key opinion leaders in terms of both science and philosophy and faith. So, you know, the book is fun. It's not, you know, too complicated. It's only 180 pages. You can read it on the weekend. But I think that I genuinely think people will enjoy the book, and I hope that they do. Otherwise, I'll have to give them some kind of money back guarantee, and then Random House can get more book contracts.
I think they're gonna love it. Well, Dr. J, thank you so much for taking the time to join us. Listeners, the book is The Mind of God, available anywhere you can buy a book. Dr. Jay Lombard is a neurologist who spent a lot of time studying psychiatry as well, and connects for us the science of the brain with spirituality and with the presence of God. I hope you take a moment to read it and really change our universe. Thank you, Dr. Jay.
Oh, thank you so much. This was an absolute pleasure. God bless you. Thank you.
Thank you.